Welcome to Global Minnesota Podcasts, connecting, informing, and engaging Minnesotans with the world and exploring important international issues. For a complete list of programs and to join us, visit globalminnesota.org.
Okay, hello everybody, and thank you again for coming on behalf of the U.S. Department of State. Thank you all for coming out. I do want to send a shout out also to Global Minnesota, Carolina, Tim, and Sean. For putting this together at relatively short notice, if you might be aware how this works, they get an email from somebody back in the home office in D.C. Hey, do you want to host Larry? Who's Larry? Well, he's from Nigeria. Okay, that sounds good to me. Let's make it happen. And within about 2 or 3 weeks, this month came together. Dr. Curtin also stepped in from the Humphrey Institute, so thank you very much for hosting here as well. And so here we are, and we can begin this informal presentation after two quick caveats. One, I'm not an expert in Nigeria. I spent about 26 months there in Lagos. Right? And I know quite a bit about it because I lived there and worked there and met out a lot of folks there, but knowing you're an expert, I can give you some of the details that I've learned over time, but if you've been really deep and dirty, and that's a good diminishing, I might have to dig a little bit deeper. Number two, these opinions that I say today are mine. They're not the U.S. government's or not the Department of State. So please keep that in mind too. If I do a good enough job, you won't know the difference. But the reality is, these are my personal opinions. Right? So I think with that, we can maybe get into some of the formal presentation. So how many folks are here in January 2016 when I did the last talk? I mean, at least a handful. Okay. You guys know, January 2016. I gave a presentation on a similar thing. I was on the ground about 7 months at the time. And when we were working through this, we were talking with Ken. Do you really want me to talk? I've only been on the ground 7 months. And his response to me is, well, it's 7 months more than anybody else. So that gives me this expertise in terms of talking here today. Okay? So one thing I did last time, which I thought worked pretty well, is when I say the word Nigeria, what comes to mind? And so maybe we'll start there. So just either shout it out or raise your hand. What do you think? Okay, good one. Okay. One of the most populous countries, so economically as well. Boko Haram, okay, that's always on top of the tongue out there too. The largest tribe, significant amounts of that for sure. Okay, Biafra, we'll talk about some of that as well today. Some of the secessionist movements that are out there too. Yeah, and why haven't you? I mean, obviously, they're sitting there. Just before I left, they found $46 million U.S. dollars in an apartment about 3 blocks from my apartment. $46 million U.S. dollars. Right after you had just answered the email. But you didn't, so unfortunately, you're an agency. So, true story on that $46 million. So, what's interesting about that response is the last time I did this, number one was Boko Haram, by the way. Three today, right? So, that is actually a reality and a perception that Boko Haram is still a threat, but a little less so than it was before, even just 18, 19 months ago. So, we can talk about some of those issues. I didn't know corruption, which I heard last time, right? Also, an endemic issue in Nigeria, but not on top of mind here as well. Oil was number one, I think, and certainly that's an issue, especially because they don't do a very good job at maintaining their oil reserves and some of those issues as well. Yeah, but I'm going to offer you other words too. Okay? I did this last time, and I think it makes sense to do it again. Meeting 35,000 Nigerians on a visa level, which is the size of Target too. Right? Just every day, over and over again, doing that kind of thing. Immigrant visas as well, about 4,000 or 5,000 of those, and new families reunited in Nigeria. But also some of the folks that we talked to in terms of environmental issues, and wildlife trafficking issues, and political issues, and economic issues that I've done. So all those issues are there. So entrepreneurship is a big one that is very much vitally important in Nigeria. Entrepreneurship, innovation. The Facebook team, and led by Zuckerberg Foundation, has a technology hub that they're building out of the United States in Lagos, which is not far from the consulate, actually, where they go and try to find the best of the best of my Nigerians. No education required, they have to pass the test, and are 1 in 1,000 pass the test. That's how many people take the test, gives you an idea. They've met over 150 fellows. But this Endala Foundation, among other things, are really driving the force of technology in Nigeria and technology development, so app development especially, that's what they do. And they send folks out to San Francisco and other places to hone some of those American business skills in addition to their technology skills. So entrepreneurship is still important. Now, we see that on an industrial level. We also see it on a day-to-day level. Outside, hawkers are selling peanuts 5 to 3. Stick them in their fingers like this and walk down the street with them and they're stuck in traffic. That's entrepreneurship too. And there's a really competing issues around there. Do we let them continue doing that, or do we clean up the streets? And the argument against, of course, is, well, if we let them continue doing that, then the traffic continues, people get hurt, we've seen people get run over, right outside the apartment. The alternative is, if we clean them all up, then what do they do? What do they do? Where do they go? Do they then decide to fall into the Boko Haram issues, terrorism issues, all of that? So it's a complicated sort of situation. The religious strife is certainly a big one, too. So the religious aspect of it is important. But like most places, what you hear about are the extremists, not necessarily the folks who live in day-to-day lives, but as truthful, like religious Christians, religious Muslims, paganism, is animism, is also out there, too. I'll tell you a story about an animist and sentiments that are out there, which is real. Animism is not familiar as chief-sickers, people who can turn into goats and animals, things like that, too. So that is a real thing. And we have to respect that as Americans, as American diplomats, as that is the entity and that they grow up in. So the religious aspects of it, too, are really important. So I often use those words as well, in addition to the words that we talked about before. So I'm going to go ahead and forward this. What do we do in the State Department? There's a flyer outside that talks about this. Part of the home time to that program is for me to come out and tell you that we exist out there, by the way. There are about 8,000 Foreign Service officers, maybe double that in terms of specialists and the folks who do a lot of the work on service as well. And we have about maybe 25 or 30,000 civil servants, mainly based in Washington, but also scattered around the country. And we also have our local and locally engaged staff. Those are the folks that are locally hired generally to help support us in embassies and missions in the world, too. What do? We create American jobs, and I don't have to read this, you can get the flyer up front. But it's very important for everyone to realize that American democracy is part of what we do overseas. And these are some elements that we do. If you ever travel to Nigeria, I encourage you to do so, but if you do, make sure you register first. And we can help you out there in case any of these things happen. About 300 missions around the world. This is a map. Kind of fuzzy, you can't really tell. A lot of the black dots are where we are around the world. If you divide 8,000 by 300 or so, you get about 25 or so. So there are about 25 Foreign Service officers per mission around the world, which is a really nice lot when you think about it. And when you think about it too, there's a running joke within the State Department that basically says there are more military band members than there are Foreign Service officers. This is true. Okay. I'm not disparaging DOD or the band. I'm just stating a fact that's out there, that there are very few of us compared to the DOD that's out there as well. So we are scattered all around the world, anywhere from Iraq and Afghanistan and down to Lagos, which is, of course, what I was one of the best friends of in Lagos is in Buenos Aires now, and all the ones that things like Berlin, Milan, all the nice places, but all the very not so nice places, too. And places you might think sound nice on paper are not that nice in reality. Like Fiji sounds great, right? Cuba is not a very nice place. It's a bit of a dictatorship these days. Very dirty, crime-ridden, but very important in terms of its location in the Pacific, as well as a lot of the issues that we deal economically with Fiji. So, speaking directly about U.S. Embassy in Nigeria, this is right off the webpage today. This is our new ambassador, Ambassador Symington. He just arrived a few months ago, and we had the pleasure to meet him and travel with him quite a bit. And these are also his folks that deal with HIV issues that are out there, too. Nigeria is one of the largest recipients of PEPFAR. This is the presidential declaration basically gives money for AIDS and HIV research and combat. Yeah. So they're signing an agreement here about almost $500 million. And this is some of the things that the U.S. government does in Nigeria, not just in Nigeria, but also around the world. I think a lot of folks have seen similar type of graphs here. From left to right, you've got the map of Nigeria, the blue is in the middle. A walk over here, and this is where it's located in Africa. And this is probably the most famous map the Economist ever put on this for this Economist. This is how big is Africa. Right? When you look at a map, generally because of the Mercator projections and the stretching of the northern and southern latitudes, stuff looks really big up top, and Africa, because it's roughly on the equator, looks really small. you can see you can fit China, the United States, all of India, all of most of Western Europe, all of the UK, and other countries within the country of Africa. Don't make that mistake. It's not a country. And people don't ask, well, you know, what do they speak there? What language do they speak? It's a very unusual kind of set of questions. And again, it's a part of my job too when I come home, is help educate folks on what Africa is, how big it is, how big Nigeria is, which is about twice the size of California, by the way. Nigeria is about twice the size of California. And roughly from Lagos, where I was, up to Lake Chad area, it's about the distance, about 800 miles, that's San Diego to the Golden Gate. You can think of it that way too. And that's how far it is too. And right in the middle, you got Abuja, which is a relatively new capital, much like Washington, D.C., where the land is set aside, and that's where it all look. You have the embassy in Abuja, and I live down in Lagos. Down here on this side, well, actually, I have to move this. So, I'm going to put them down. This is languages. I'm going to go. Okay, here we go. So we talk about Nigeria itself, in terms of what it is and what it's not. Nigeria is a group of people who were thrown together after World War I, basically, when they drew the boundaries and after the Treaty of Versailles and said, Britain, here's what you have, because they defeated a group, of course, with the Germans and the Italians. The Germans had Cameroon with a K, and that was given to France, who became Cameroon with a C, and that's where you get the Cameroon from. But this is a map of the languages that are spoken. These are the major ones. The Yoruba are on this side, on the southwestern side. And Igbo is sort of over here. This is actually Cameroon. Igbo over here, that's a completely different language. And roughly, if you drew a line right in the middle to the north, that's the Hausa language. And mostly Muslim up there, the Hausa Fulani folks. But you can easily see within the middle, there are at least a couple dozen languages just on each chart. And reality is there's over 500 ethnic languages in Nigeria. 500 ethnic languages in Nigeria. There are over 200 different independent cultures. And one of the states, you can kind of see them. I'm sorry if it's a little difficult to see, but Oyo, Ogun, Ondo, Kwara, Kogi. And then I've got the middle region, sort of the middle belt, sort of up here. And down here, the Edo. And these are the Igbo folks down in this area. And then you've got the Hausa Fulani folks on the other side. The thing that's worth talking about, how this came to be. Right? Again, after World War I, when the Germans were defeated, and Germans were defeated, the French and the English sat down and said, okay, Britain, you can have Nigeria, I'll take Cameroon with the sea, and I'll take Togo from the Germans, that are now French. Benin went to the French, Ghana went to the English, Namibia went to South Africa, so essentially the UK at the time. So all these countries were carved up without any real consideration for who actually lived there. When you think about that. So back in Versailles, when they drew up this map, they didn't really care who was there. They cared more about the resources that they knew were there. They knew that there might be potential for rubber. They knew there might be potential for coal and some sort of mine. At the time, they didn't have oil there, which is a whole other thing that came up later. But this is what happened. And since then, really, they said, you need to get along. We call this, you know, the number one. And they don't really want to get along. They've never really gotten along. They're so disparate in what, the way they think and the way that they act that they really don't want to get along. Although, I should say that many of them really do for the better of Nigeria. They know that secession is not a reality, although they're trying to be off the war in 1967, 1970. Killed about 3 million people, mostly through starvation and naval blockades. And the guys who led that on a pro-Nigeria side had the airport named after him and later became president of Nigeria. So you can see that the southeastern folks, the Igbo folks, really felt like since then, especially, they have had very little to no representation in the government and what they want to do. When oil was found, that created a whole other can of worms there. So, talking about Biafra a little bit, this is the full country. And then over here, on the upper right, is the map of Biafra at the time. So this is what had claimed to be Biafra. Nobody was going to be the capital of Biafra, like a state. And then you come down here in Calabar. Port Harcourt is a major oil place that's up there now. And these are the states that are down in the Delta region. These are the Niger Delta regions down here. So they overlap pretty well. Between what's here, roughly, this line is roughly here, these are the Bounty Delta folks, and this is where all the oil is. So the Igbo and the Sanok say, well, I have all these resources. Why do I need to share? I don't want to share these resources. It didn't start out that way. It started out, okay, we'll see how this works. And then they didn't feel they were getting a fair share of whatever was happening, both within the government and economically. In the government, traditionally, because Abuja is relatively close geographically to the north, a lot of the folks that run the NNPC, which is the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, are Hausa from the north, 6 out of 9, which is a gross misrepresentation. There's no oil north of this region. There's no oil up there. And yet, the folks running that quote-unquote non-profit organization are all from the north. So you're the ones dictating terms to the folks who have the oil, and they said enough. So there's enough of a movement now where they are looking at secession once again. Something between secession and reorganization, redistricting, restructuring, thank you. And yet, by the way, in Nigeria, my wife, Nigeria, she was in a political section in Nigeria for about 8 months or so, and this was the reason. So she knows this really well. If anyone has any real questions about this, please leave me one for the details. I'll give you the one into the region of all of this. So that's basically what happens. And now we're looking at a situation where they're not getting the reserves that they want. They're not getting the economics that they believe they deserve, the evil folks, and so they're now pulling back again. So there's a fellow named Nnamdi Kanu, who was an exiled Igbo leader over in England and in the United States for a while. And he came back to Nigeria and was promptly arrested. So upon his arrest, he spent about 2 years in jail. And there's a rallying point around him to try to get him out or cause some of his trouble. In response, the federal government went down and basically declared martial law, military law, on a lot of these states, arrested and killed protesters who were demanding the release of Kanu. In addition to that, in the north, there was a group of folks who basically said, you know, as of October 1st of this year, if you're Igbo, you must leave these states. And if you don't, we will come and kill you. So here we have a government at the time didn't do anything about that, I suppose. So here we have a situation where the Igbo were trying to get their economic concerns known. The government came in and crushed them militarily. The North said, we want you Igbo to leave, and they didn't do anything about that. So there was a tacit agreement, it seemed like at the time, a tacit agreement that the government was supporting the House of folks in the North at the expense of the folks in the Southeast. And that tension is still going on now. We're not at October 1 yet. The world is waiting to see what's going to happen. So are they going to carry through with this? Now, there have been some inroads into helping in that situation, but it certainly isn't something that has been prioritized or rectified as of today, as of religious history, as I try to look at this. So that's probably one of the biggest issues right now, is the Igbo secessionist movement has reared its head again. They tend to be overeducated. If you're familiar with a lot of the books that come out of Nigeria, many of them are Igbo, Chinua Achebe, right? Yep, Chimamanda is another one, right? Capital is Americana, possibly the greatest piece of African literature, things called Punk, is also an Igbo person. So they feel like they have not only the economics and intellectual capacity and the skills and capabilities to run the country, but they feel like they've largely been left out of the government. Whether we agree with that, I don't know, because if you listen to the North side, the North side says, we give them plenty of opportunity to join, and they refuse to join because they want to secede. So why don't you allow secessionist movement into the country? That's just going to undermine what we want to do up here. So that's a lot of the competing forces, I think. Whether or not you buy that is a question of the northern or the southeastern. The Yoruba folks on the southwest, they care a little bit less. They care about the economic thing. Lagos is the commercial capital of Nigeria. It's like New York City. And London and other lands dropped into one. 20, 25 million people live in Nigeria on an infrastructure that's built from 3 to 5. And we have power outages every single day. We had a traffic jam 2 to 3 miles long just to go across the bridges, half a mile away. And so we spend a lot of time playing board games and other things. and walking around the corner to shop and eat because we couldn't really go anywhere after afternoon when everyone was sort of reaching back and forth. So that is a situation of the ethnic group that are there now. Take a few questions on the things I talked about before I get into the photo challenge tutorial. I'm going to press on the back. Intervention isn't a word that I would use. We are diplomatically and very truthfully working towards a solution. We have brought folks to the table. I visited out there, and I think you went out there like 8 or 9 times with the ambassadors sometimes. Met with the Igbo leader, so the grand poobah of Igbo land, sat at the table with the ambassador, and we need to work out this theory about the Igbo land. This is quite extraordinary. And everything that I've told you is essentially what they want. They want better representation. They want this idea that they belong at the table and have been refused on the norm. So our intervention, to use that word, is to encourage them to sit down and become one Nigerian. That the greater good is better than what you guys are looking for. They have some valid concerns. They really do. But secession is not the answer. And neither is completely ignoring the norm, which is what they would prefer to do. Their idea is that it's not my problem that they're starving the norm, because we would come back and go, hey, you've got the muscle farming folks, so they're kind of starving up there. Or they don't have the resources you guys do. You need to share it. You're one nation. And they basically said, I don't care. It's such an irrelevancy to them. They don't have that. Mainly because of the tribalism that I talked about before. The community issues that they deal with out there, the family unit is the most important unit, and then the community, and then your village, and then your tribe. After that, it kind of falls apart a little bit. What's interesting, though, when you come out and do these talks and talk about Nigeria folks, I'm not sure that there's a country in the world that has such a negative reputation as Nigeria. When I tell people I spent 2 years in Nigeria, I get this blank look, or I get all the sorts of questions, and there are some people based on, who this person is, or who do I feel like talking about this, I'll say I will still work at the bank sometimes. It's true. But I believe it sometimes in general, I can say, don't go do that. But that's kind of what it feels like sometimes. It was a stressful time to be there. I had much less gray hair than I do now. Every single gray hair was earned, I tell you. But at the same time, the work is still happening. I encourage you to get out there and read about it and get involved in the situation, get involved in Africa, get involved in Nigeria. One way you can do that is through some online groups that you can work through. There are NGOs you can work through as well. There are donations you can do as well. You do need everything from end to end. There's nothing that you're not trying to do. They'll do any work that you can. Yes, sir. It's meant to be, yes. It's meant to be. The question is, the judicial system and the administrative system in Nigeria, what is it about? It was modeled after the U.S. Constitution. The Nigerian Constitution was modeled after the U.S. Constitution. This concept of states, this concept of representation, this concept of senators and governors was modeled after the United States. The problem that comes up is that the folks who are in power want to stay in power and, very frankly, get rich being in power. And that's just the bottom line. So the corruption issues that are out there are real. The laws they have in their books are really good. If you ever read Nigerian law, and I have, which I'm unfortunately, they're really good. Some of the challenges around Nigerian law is that it's very specific. One of the advantages of American law sometimes is that it's not. There's room for interpretation in some of our laws, and so the judges, and we go up, and we have this sort of back and forth. But in Nigerian law, if it's not there, it doesn't exist. And that's a different kind of problem. So the administrative system is very similar to the American system in the civil. You have a divorce, you have a law, you have the federal, you have the state. So all of those are very similar. So any question here? Exactly. One of the benefits of living and working in a life place in Nigeria is that no one really wants to go there. So if you really want to go there, you're really good, and you really want to go there. So he's a career foreign service officer. And he is a three-time ambassador. He was in Djibouti before, and then he was in Rwanda, and then he was in Nigeria. So this is his third ambassadorial posting. And he's been in the service for a very long time. And his father is actually a senator from Missouri, and Senator Simonton. And that he's not ringing a bell to some folks. That was his father. And he comes from a very long history of a political family, and he's leveraged that very, very well in his own merits. He's a terrific guy, and I really enjoyed working with him all the time. Thanks so much. Yeah, sure. The threat is still very real. So one of the things that, a couple of things that happened after Buhari was elected president. One was he moved much of the resources, military resources, they were sending to Abuja and even down the south. The second Boko Haram was up in the northeast. I'll go back to a little bit. I mentioned before that there's someone sitting. The distance from Lagos roughly to Lake Chad up there is within a mile, San Diego to the border of Oregon. So up in the Gregory is where this stuff was happening. Boko Haram was set up on the island in Lake Chad, using that as a base, using boats and canoes to get across the river, rampaging the villages surrounding it and go back to their little forests up in the area. But there were no military assets at that time, there were very few at the time. We're not really sure why. When Goodluck Jonathan was in charge, he kept everyone in Abuja and down south because he felt that's where the resources were. Before, many of you mentioned before, they're not on folks care about the north, and that's part of the problem. That's how Boko Haram came to be. No one cared about the north. And then the government had a crackdown and killed the leader at the time, Musa, executed him basically, which was extrajudicially, in addition to his family. And then he was replaced by a guy named Chicago, who now has taken it from this Oregon Tech Police or Tech Military, which is not good. But he's taken to another level and said, now we're going after villages and civilians. So that is what has happened historically. The United States has helped put some of this down as well. We trained some of the folks, we trained some of their military, we trained some of the police, and we've encouraged them to move some of these assets as well as we can do it to systems too. So Boko Haram is still a threat. It's not as bad as it was before. Still pretty bad. Still not allowed to go up there. But it will probably be a lingering issue for a very long time. You always have these ones to teach. Yes. Yeah. Well, I can't speak to the Gregory in particular, but I can speak to some of the friction markets in general. And what happens in Nigeria is that they're looking for more all the time. So we would give them some assets, sell them some assets to be able to look for some assets. But for the assets that we give them, sometimes linger and rot on the runways of the airport. So if you fly in, you'll see American planes sitting on the tarmac outside of the city that have never been flown, never been used, but somehow they've been purchased. They don't do a very good job of maintaining them. So it's not just a question of selling them the assets, but also teaching them to maintain it and use them effectively. So that's the situation we're in now. We're not sure when you give me more stuff, because the stuff we gave you, I still see it not being used very well. So let's think about relearning and retraining some of this. Again, a caveat remind you that these are my personal opinions. So, I don't believe China is in the business of nation building. They're not. They're in the business of money, the business of currency. They're in the business of a quid pro quo that they might, try to cash in sometime down the road. They won't do it right away. But they'll say, okay, here's some money for a bridge, here's some money for a highway, here's some money for this or that. Why don't you give me some of the rights that come from them, whether it's logging or something else? And then somewhere down the line, we'll talk about something that we need to do. The United States approach, which I fully agree with, is if you want this bridge, or if you want this entity that we plan to build for you, we need to do some things first. Take care of human rights issues. Take care of civil rights issues. Talk about some of the democracy that has to go on. See, maybe put down some of these insurrections that are going on first. So the U.S. approach is always something tied to something. And that works for us pretty well. you don't want to get involved. I don't believe we want to get involved in this situation. We're giving things away, not for free necessarily, but without something in return. And that's a transactional relationship that we believe in. That we enjoy the meaning. The Chinese transaction or approach is economic control. And I think that's the biggest disparity between the two. Yeah, it's all good. And I have a specific example later in my photo column. You'll see it. So let's move on to this kind of that. Yes. Yes, we know what's being spent, we know what it's being spent on. Historically, I don't think this is unique to the State Department necessarily, but sometimes it's tough to know how the money's being used and really what's the effect of that usage, not just today and tomorrow, but 5, 10, 15 years from now. I think that's the biggest challenge is we've given them some assets, we've given them some assistance. What is their long-term effect on this? So we build a school, we won't see the result of that school for generations, but yet we know it's a positive thing. So yes, the money is being tracked, and yes, we're trying very hard to be sure that the efficacy of that money is also being tracked. And so this one. I mean, there's a lot of concern about Wuhan. I believe in the last year, he's been in the country about 2 months or so. He's recovering in the United Kingdom for most of his time. He was diagnosed with cancer and he's undergoing cancer treatment. His vice president has largely been in charge. Now, I believe this. Had this happened 10 years ago, we might see something very different than we do today. Historically, when a leader has left Nigeria, there's been a coup. It's happened. It happened many times over the 80s and 90s. We haven't had that happen. Buhari's been away for 10 of the last 12 months, and yet we still have a good and functioning government, people we could work with. Now, I shouldn't say that the vice president is in charge. What I'm saying is that he is at least right now in the country, and we can funnel our requests and the marches and all the other good stuff through him, through Buhari and the United Kingdom. So I think he's doing an effective job. I think he has a very big uphill battle. I mean, good luck, Jonathan. For all of his faults and for all of his pros, there are a lot of things left unchecked. But let's be clear about something about Nigeria, too. As a country, it's only been in existence since 1960. 1960 is the first year of independence for Nigeria, right? I'm going to take a guess and say there are folks in this room born before 1960. So there are people in this room who are older than this country. Think about where we were 60 years ago, 50 years ago, after 1776. We hadn't even fought the Civil War yet. We hadn't fought the Spanish-American War yet. We hadn't finished all the other wars that we tried to get into after that period, too. We needed time to get through this, and I think they really are through this. We had the first peaceful transition of power in its history last time. That's a phenomenal thing to think about when you think about it. Okay? So when you think about they've only been in existence since 1960, they've had a relatively peaceful go of it in the last little bit. We've had a president who is duly elected out of the country, and yet his vice president has not been assassinated. That's a plus, right? So these are all good things that I think we can look forward to as this country matures, as it grows, as it gets economics and good. That's fine. Oh, yeah, good. That is true, and it's really two groups, but yes, that's absolutely true. So as part of the Constitution, a little bit different from ours, is that when the president is elected, let's say he comes from the north, the vice president must be from the south. And then the next time around, the president must come from the south, and the vice president comes from the north. That way, these ethnic issues have sort of been mitigated. The problem is many of these folks have not lasted very long in that capacity. So Yoruba was a duly elected Northern president. And before Goodluck Jonathan was his vice president. He died in office after a year, the Northern guy. Goodluck Jonathan took over as a president, as per the Constitution, won again, re-elected. So he was out of turn to the Northerners. The Northerners said, wait a second, we should have left him. Obviously, we should have an Northern guy replace him or something like that. So this is the ongoing battle between the North and the South. And now we're in Buhari, right? Because Goodluck was a president before. Buhari is a president now. He's a Northerner. And hopefully we'll see that peaceful transition continue back and forth. So that's the way it is. The bulk of it goes towards HIV, and so PEPFAR. They're the biggest recipient of PEPFAR in the world, really. And it's helped, I wouldn't say eliminate, but certainly has put HIV under control in that country. And they also get a lot of malaria money, too. They do get some military aid, just like most countries do. They get foreign aid, and they also get money that says, here's some money, do some good with it. And that happens as well. And the volume I can't speak to, but doesn't mention it. Very much so, yes. They speak to mostly the South and a bit to the North in terms of agriculture issues and health issues as well. So malaria is now one of the biggest next strategies outside of AIDS. So malaria now is one of the biggest issues. Okay, so I'll go through photo collage. This might trigger some more questions for you. Okay. Well, I will say part of why I'm here is if you want to join the Foreign Service, I'm happy to take some questions after. There's some documents outside. I need to be 59 on entry on duty. So we have to start like around 57 at the latest, realistically. So I'll just put that out there. Okay. So I haven't forgotten the folks who might be interested in joining the Foreign Service. I'll go from there. Yes, sir. Cool. Yes, sir. Thank you. Okay, so over the photo collage, there are 2 pages of this. So Flag Day is the day you find out where you're going in the Foreign Service. And after 5 or 6 weeks of training, you literally get a flag with your country on it, handed to you by your mentor. And my mentor, our past mentor was Tom Sherman. He's now the Undersecretary of Political Affairs. He's actually the Assistant Secretary of State. And as we're waiting for Tillerson to be confirmed. So Tom Sherman was ours. Up your left, and that was Anita. And she wasn't that happy that day, but put on a good face. And as an aside, you know, when I said where I wanted to go, I told them I wanted another language. I wanted something within my calling, which is management, so something operational, perhaps. And of course, I got no language, and I got something completely outside my calling. And here it is. A lot of friends went to Milan, and Dan, and Auckland, and I went to Lagos. The upper right is me inspecting a building. We're looking at maybe looking at a new housing compound and one of the big facilities out there. So the hat is made for a Nigerian head, not my big head, so it looks kind of funny. Upper left, on bottom left, looking at it is St. Patty's Day. So I played bagpipes, so we went out to do bagpiping with Will and Mustic and Arnold. And the middle one is a little bit of informal diplomacy. This guy is a chief in Nigeria. This was a consulate event where UK Art Gallery is one of the biggest art galleries in Lagos, in all of Nigeria. And this guy lived and worked in New York City, and so did I. He was very pleased to meet me. He had a very hearty handshake. And I'm just saying hello. Bottom right is my dogs. I have 2 dogs. And you can see the little one on the left here. His little Pomeranian. And I'm playing Pokemon Go, and so that's what I'm doing there, outside the pool. And my bagpipe stuff on the left is the British High Commission, so I was the only bagpiper in Nigeria. And so I got invited to some of these events. The guy on the right is an admiral in the Navy, and the guy left was a staff assistant. So this was for the Queen's birthday, so I played for the Queen's birthday. She wasn't there, but the event was the Queen's birthday. To the right, and one is a tugboat that's washed ashore in Tarka Bay. It's not there anymore, but this is the Frigga from Stockholm. You can kind of see that out there. I researched Frigga, and what I found was Frigga was a Swedish tugboat vessel that lost a barge that was meant to tow it. And right after it lost its barge, it was decommissioned and sold to Nigeria. So there's a metaphor there, as I stand on the front of it. And that is a true story. That is a true story. Friends of His Excellency, we went to the Oil State Governor Gubernatorial Inauguration. That was my chair, Friends of His Excellency. And I sat there. He was a very nice guy. I waved to him. This is This is a place called Makoko. It's a floating city. There's a BBC documentary on Makoko. You can see it on YouTube. It's on the lawn. Worth reading. And these are folks who live and breathe and work on the water. They many of them never touch land. There's schools on the land. Their economies on the land. Most of it's fishing and logging. On the top left is a guy throwing his fishing nets, and the guy's in his plane. And the bottom left is a kid coming back with some gravel. The right one is a bit of an outlier. That's from a different part of the country, but these are kids playing in Crossover State. Upper left is our ambassador speaking with an ex-governor's wife, Madame Duke, as well as some folks from the Nigerian Conservation Elite. So one of my jobs out there was Environmental Science Technology and Health Reporting Officer, ESTH. And I picked up the wildlife trafficking and environmental portfolio, which is part of it. So what we're trying to do is, we were trying to raise awareness of the wonders and beauty of Nigerian natural resources, which are being completely abused over there. The governor of the state, Crossroads State, had proposed a highway to run across the middle of it, across and through the national forest, for example. And he was dedicating 25% of his entire state to this superhighway. It's about the size of New Jersey, this state, so it's a very, very large superhighway. And by the way, he would sell $3 billion of logging rights to the Chinese company that would build the road. So we went in there, didn't say don't do it, because that's not our role. What we did instead was go through a 5-day tour, starting from the tip to the bottom, and raising awareness along the way with our ambassador in town, our consultant too, raising awareness about some of the issues that this could raise, including deforestation, including some of the animals that are out there. This is Anita crossing one of the bridges with Madame Duke behind her. And this was a very scary bridge, I thought, so I was happy to be across it. The bottom one is the Kuri village. So this is sort of in the middle of Cross River. The entire village came out to greet us. We had VIP seats. There's the consul general down here on the left, his bodyguard and the glasses in the middle, and then all the folks who came out to visit us. It was extraordinary. These people live literally in the middle of the forest, traditional rulers, and they came out for this huge event. Unfortunately, it didn't stay very long. It took a very long time to get there, but this is a kind of emotions that we see sometimes when we do these kinds of tours. The American presence is welcome to Nigeria. It is something that is important, and it's something that Nigerians really value. So of all the nations that are there, I dare say, they like the Americans first. They really do believe that. We really do feel truly loved in Nigeria. It's extraordinary. Summer's Lodge is the hotel that I could have stayed at, and that's the information office on the left. For Climber's Lodge. I didn't stay there, just for the record. The right one on the upper right is a drill monkey. So we went and visited the drill monkey ranch. It's sort of in the middle of Cross River State. The drill ranch is an organization that was founded by two Americans who arrived in Nigeria about 30 years ago and stayed. And they decided to make conservation in Nigeria their livelihood and their lives. So they raised money through various means to save the drill monkey, among other things. And that's them on the lower left. The two white folks, Oribos, as we would say in Nigeria, with our ambassador on the right, and then our head chief of the state in the middle. And then the back is off the mountain, the blue monkeys live when they're released. And then with some of the roads I was talking about, really difficult to get to. This is a 5-ton vehicle crossing a wooden platform across the stream. We made it, barely, but we made it. And to the right are some bananas that they use for the drill monkeys. Upper left was a kid who lived on a ranch and sort of helped out too. He basically fed the animals and cleaned water. Upper right is some of the deforestation happens for cassava planting. So this is an illegal farm that was built in the middle of the national forest. It's like if you wound up in a national forest, decided to clear cut 3 acres and plant some potatoes, that's what's happening here. But there's very little in the way of any administrative rules or regulations enforcement, and that's part of the problem that's happening now. This will likely turn into an arid desert within a dozen years or so, and nothing's going to grow there, which is quite unfortunate. More pictures with the drill monkeys, and then this is the restroom along the way. This is what counts as a rest stop. Upper left is a young Fulani herdsman. So this is a very small crop photo as they were whizzing by in the car. His herd was easily 1,000 cattle. It was quite easily 1,000 cattle. And this is a cross river state, so quite a bit away from home. And what he was doing with his friends and family was bringing his cattle down to the farmlands in the south and then basically eating all the crops of the farmers that are down there. This is one of the biggest issues that are happening right now with the climate herdsmen and the folks in the southeast. Why isn't anyone doing anything about this? Says the evil man who has a farm. Meanwhile, these folks say, well, I don't have any food up there, so I need to bring my cattle down. And this has caused, genocide, because it's not, but this has caused thousands of deaths in northern and middle and Nigeria. This exact kind of thing, where they would walk across with their cattle, someone shoots first, and now we have a situation, especially retaliation. Upper right is a museum. Pathway, and this is one of their guns. And we travel everywhere with guns. We have guns with guns, so we trust them. The guy on the left is one of the high chiefs from that large village thing I talked about before, this one down here. So it's a close up of the table, it's sort of in the middle. And on the right, on the bottom, is the Oba of Lagos. He's the king of Lagos with his stuffed lions. So he cannot hold the microphone himself, his assistant does for him, and it's very unusual, but very interesting kind of thing he's doing. Quite a speech. This is in the market. This is a woman balancing, it turns out to be peanuts on her head. She's waiting for them to come out of the Balogun market. And on the right is one of many thousands of private shops that are in Balogun market where you can go and shop and turn it into dresses and other materials. So naturally, she's wearing something today that she got from those markets. These are the clothes that I have. And there's some work to do, too, sometimes, but it doesn't look like it all was on the outside. Upper left is me on TV. And this is a screenshot from a television news article. Several times on television, several times on radio. I basically went on the Nigerian Good Morning America show to talk about one of these things. So I have an audience based on like 30 million people right here, which is mind-boggling a little bit when you think about it. And on the right is me representing the Future Africa Awards and Summit. So I went to represent the most famous of those things. So end up pretty big here. Bottom left is back at the drill ranch. This is something I've always had up in Nigerian and American flags. And the middle one there is part of our classroom tour, investigating speech to some children. And shortly after this, just a funny story, I think, anyway, is there was some kids who gave a speech. So a kid went up and gave a speech, and he started rapping for about 8 or 9 minutes. It was, I'm not sure what he was saying, but he eventually got the hook, and we stopped him from talking. So that's the quick photo collage that I was from my time in Nigeria. And that's the end of my formal presentation, if anyone has more questions. Yes, sir. The morale is a difficult thing to measure, especially when you live overseas, because by and large, and for better or for worse, and Dr. Kim can speak about this moment, we are sometimes disconnected a bit from the home office, and we are able to do the work that we need to do without a lot of the noise that we hear. Actually in Washington, which in some ways it's quite nice. I also have another benefit that I'm fairly low level. I'm a first year commercial officer, so my job is to adjudicate visas. I don't deal with the policy, I don't deal with the programs as much, and went out and talked to folks and work things about it, but my job is limited in this way. I think where you're feeling the most open in the morale are those fairly senior folks who've been in 15, 20, 25 years in D.C. We still have a lot of gaps in the secretaryships. They are coming to be filled, and they're just taking some time. It'll work itself out. I tell people we're sort of in a pendulum now, right? We had sort of a pendulum swing the other way with Colin Powell and Hillary Clinton in terms of wrapping folks up and hiring folks and getting special envoys. And now we're sort of back the other way, looking at, does this really make sense? As a full-time business consultant, I think the exercise makes sense. We'll see where it comes after this. Thanks for having us. It's an useful question. So I was sitting in my office in my cube in the US Bank, and I got an email from Anita and said, "Hey, can you print this out for me?" And I said, "Oh, what is this?" And so it was a guide to the Foreign Service Office of Tests. Now I like tests. I just like to take them. So it's okay. This looks interesting. I'll take this and here we go. So that's kind of how it works. But it really isn't. It's a long process. So I'm short-circuiting a couple of years there. But basically, you take the exam, and then if you pass this, then you send in some short essays and what I call a resume review. And then if you pass that, then you go to DC for all day interview, basically. They put you in a room with 5 to 12 people, you work on a project, and then you write a case on a binder that's handed to you in 20 minutes. And then you have a traditional interview with two senior foreign service officers generally who would ask some questions about different things. And you pass all that. And then if you do well enough on that, you can pass and never get a job offer. If you do well enough on that, then you get pulled off the register. I'm sorry, before that even happens, then you go through medical and go through security clearance. So Foreign Service officers have top secret security clearances, and I guess it's a good thing. And then from there, you get to medical and squared away. My top secret security clearance took 416 days. It's going to be a year, which is about a year longer or so, maybe less longer than most. I wasn't born in the United States. My mother's a naturalized citizen. I had a lot of travel. And so they just had to be sure that I wasn't going to be in the United States to put school. And then I guess they were confident in all of that. So once that happens, then you get on the register and you go. Yes, sir. Yeah. That's a good question. We've talked about going back in about 20 years to see what it's like, to see how things are different. Incrementally, it's going to get better and better every time. It really is. They need to wean themselves off of the informal economy, which isn't working right now. They need to open up their protectionism issues that they have right now. So you're not allowed to import chicken, for example, or other things like that. Everything must be inside. They banned cars from coming in as well because they want to build up the auto industry. But meanwhile, they don't have infrastructure or the manpower or the knowledge to actually develop these industries in-house. And so there's this idea that, well, if we force ourselves to make it, then we will rise up and we will make it. But at a certain point, you can't wait anymore. So I think once they start looking at some of those issues and removing some of those issues, then they'll be much better off in the long term. I have very high hopes for them. I wish them well. I'm cautiously optimistic, though. By 2050, they expect to be the third most populous country in the world, after China, after India. Somewhere about 400, 500 million people, well past the United States. They're well past the expansive growth. There's a youth bulge that's out there, which have no job prospects whatsoever. They have an infrastructure in the government that is not interested in long-term planning. So I have, I'm cautiously optimistic, but I'm also watching the news very carefully. There's the one book available you can buy. It's a Brandt book, the R.A.N.D.E. They're really easy to read. As part of the mission authority, which is called, and I'm not allowed to travel. I need to report my travel, and I'm allowed to go out of certain zones. If you show up as a private citizen, you can go where you want to. I don't think you should, but you're really going to go. However, there are some amazing parts of my journey. They're really extraordinary. Cross River City, where we spent about a week, has some of the most gorgeous natural scenery you've ever seen. That's home to the Cross River Gorilla, the most endangered gorilla in the world. The drill monkeys too, very much endangered. The pangolin, which was sort of my friend and foe down there, the pangolin. They are killed for their scales, for enhancements, and stay in China. That's where they're going. But these are all the issues that I'm going to do. No. Most of the tourism, if you can call it that, is folks coming back to visit their family and friends from the United States. Very risky. They're also the most highly targeted for ransoms and kidnappings. So you can go for tourism. There's something we call the Lego store, the lucky store. So you can go to the market, you can go to the all these things like that. she's an officer. It's Amanda. She's off to Rio next, by the way. It's a really good question because they're aware that there have been changes. They're not exactly sure why, and frankly, they don't care as much. They know where the food is and know where they're going to put their herd, so that's where they're going. So they're going drifting. They're drifting further and further south as the arid landscape drifts further and further south. The Sahara stops expanding. These arid zones are expanding. It's a serious issue. When you bump that up against the deforestation issues and the palm oil industry that really wants to force our land in there too, you're in for a very, very serious situation. So I don't, that's only one of the sticking points, I think, from now to the future. When you're done, well, the weather would be nice, but I'd be very cautious with that. You named a couple areas that are very high on the list of issues that happen. I'm not saying don't go. Just take your precautions, right? Be sure you're with a security outfit that you trust, and be sure you travel together. Keep a very low profile. And don't carry a lot of money with you. Don't carry a lot of flash jewelry with you. Stay within the law. We drove around in diplomatic vehicles with diplomatic plates and fully armored vehicles most of the time. And we still had attention from the authorities. And oftentimes, unfortunately, the authorities are the ones who are going to cause trouble. They're the ones who set the roadblocks. They're the ones who are going to demand money from you. And we can just wave them off and point to a license plate or whatever it might be. You won't have that ability to do that. So I would just be very, very cautious. People do it. They come back and have wonderful experiences. Just be very careful. Register with the State Department before you go. Tell a bougie you're going to come. Register. There's a warding system that's called up there. So wardens are American citizens generally who are responsible for certain areas of the country. So these wardens are the ones you'd register with in those areas. They might be able to help you out. The embassy might tell you not to go, frankly. But I would write them and ask for maybe a security briefing that they can use to you before you go. Yeah, I get the same questions from Mike all the time. I am just inherently optimistic. Because I do have reason to be. I actually have reason to be. Because the younger generation that I've spoken with are so far engaged in the positive aspects of what they want to do in their country, in their education, in the trends that they want, and what they want to see in terms of change, they're the ones who eventually are going to tip the scales to be in a positive country. The young folks are really where it is right now. And when I mean young, I mean 18, 19, 25 years old. I don't mean 30, 35 years old. Yeah, it's true. I mean, there's a certain point where you then have enough against the law, you get out and you call them insane and your mom, right? But we've seen some folks who, in spite of all the issues, in spite of all the negative issues that they experience in their lives, still make change and affect change. So we've had, as you know, I know, you work on climate change issues, going to the UN, he's doing all that. There are folks who are creating new job opportunities out there too, because they're training their people, and for the younger people, last one in Harvard. Not all of them are going to be successful. But I'm hopeful with some of them. The Southern Maid is in the room, well, most of the Yoruba, no, the Yoruba and the House. It is. Because in order to, just like the United States in many ways, you've got Republicans, you've got Democrats. In Nigeria, you've got the PDP, and you've got a lot of changes in the city. Every time they lose, they're going to get themselves on track. So they need to nominate somebody to run, and so they may not nominate either. They really have been disenfranchised in the political system. So they run on their own, and there are governors of other states, but in terms of the national and the national governments, they're seem to be locked up. Time for the national questions? Mm-hmm. they're building it out very quickly, but the issue is the infrastructure is required to make it happen in a meaningful way. The roads are awful. There's very little refrigeration. There's very little farm to market opportunities. So getting stuff out for agriculture is very hard. Dangote, who's man in Africa, has set up a tomato plant, for example. Industrial tomato plant, many tens of thousands of tons of tomatoes. He can't get enough tomatoes in Nigeria. Tomatoes, by the way, banned from the game to the tree, so he can't export as much as he wants to. There are and have been grain exports in the government. We sat down and visited with the governor of the state, who was very keen on telling us about his new airport, is now shutting up part of the route to the United Kingdom, and has cleared the customs and all that, so he's very proud of that. We do use the regional items, but it's very difficult to get this stuff out. We do, So the U.S. Consulate in Miami, depending on where it is, the embassy of the consulate will take a lead on that. An economic officer who does recommend exports, we have a foreign commercial officer who's not quite Steve, but he works on the offices of the mission. And he's a really good guy who works with them as well. And we also have a lot of U.S. EMT folks and also city folks up in Abuja. One of the things you get to do, the better part is, as I mentioned, a lot of stuff called control unit. So you want to work with VIPs in town. So I ordered the Secretary of Pittsburgh, which is in town, and talk about some economic things that we're looking to do in January of 2016. I'm our Secretary of Planning, so. The problem is true. The palm industry is one of the leading exports in Nigeria. It is the idea that palm is going to save Nigeria from the water. So part of that exercise in the Western State, where they were going to build this big superhighway through, they were going to clear 3 miles on either side to deforest it, sell the logging to China, and build a palm oil truck all along the 200-mile highway. The issue with that is palm oil is good, it doesn't grow everywhere. And it also only lasts like 10 to 15 years. And once it's done, it's extracted all of the nutrients out of the land. And after 10 to 15 years, that land literally is desert. There's nothing left on the land. You can't find anything else on the land without a lot of work. So it's another example of short-term gains that are trading off against the future of Nigeria. There is a place for palm oil when it's on the land. Saying don't keep palm oil. But there are tracts of land that are better suited to it than others. And if their idea is to transition from the liquid natural resource of water to the liquid natural resource of palm oil, that's the recipe for the innovation. That's something that's not consistent. So as you draw up and down in Cross River cities, you saw many examples of forests being cleared for palm oil. These tracts of land, like acres, thousands of acres of western palm oil, many of them Chinese companies. I think that's true. So a lot of Chinese companies that are doing this, again, for the short term gain and the long term that we have done so. Well, that's a really good question. The question is, what is Nigeria in the context of West Africa and maybe within the context of Africa itself? Nigeria not that long ago, was considered one of the strongest and most assertive countries in all of Africa. They really wanted to help it down, prices and settle down in that area, but then those civil war in the area, for instance, and they were leading these efforts in the 90s. Somewhere along the way, they kind of became a little more nationalistic and they became more kind. But they do have decent relationships with Cameroon and with Ghana and Nigeria and with Benin. I would say that Cameroon is they have a military relationship with them, which runs troubles that they help fight off around in the Chad region. So there's a lot of that. Economically, it's still have the same issues. Now, getting things across the border in Ghana are difficult. There was a breakdown with the auto industry where they're not allowing any cars coming in Benin anymore. They banned that, I mentioned that earlier. But that was because they didn't believe that Benin was doing a part in really ensuring that these cars were going to be tariffs that come across the border. So they said, okay, no more cars in Benin. So it's not just really trade war, but they have become much more conscious about the last decade or so. And I think that has created some economic issues that hopefully they're going to come to.